I'm Jack. I see you are still having no luck catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George. But Lord, you are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started. I reckon your boys are letting you down, George. They can't be much good, can they?
Hello and welcome back to Season 3 of Listening to the Dead.
Hello and welcome to Episode 3, Season 3 of Listening to the Dead. This episode's on handwriting, document analysis, and the case of John Humble, the hoax Yorkshire Ripper. Today, we're joined by Chris Davies, who's a handwriting and document analysis expert, Linda and Kaz, obviously, everyone joining down the line from where they are. And we go back to October 1975, to the beginning of this case, when Peter Sutcliffe committed his first murder, brutally bludgeoning and stabbing Wilbur McCann in Leeds. By 1978, he'd killed a further seven times across northwest England. The police investigation was the largest in British history. They were now looking for the Yorkshire Ripper. The investigation had a number of clues quite early on. They had a victim who'd survived the Ripper and said that he had a distinct Leeds or Bradford accent. They also had tire marks and a £5 note that he'd given to one of his victims. But despite all of this, they were no closer to finding the perpetrator. However, the clues had led them to investigating and interviewing hundreds of suspects, including Sutcliffe, but they couldn't get the breakthrough. And then, on the 8th of March 1978, Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield received a letter. It read, "Dear Sir, I'm sorry I cannot give you my name for obvious reasons. I am the Ripper. I've been dubbed a maniac by the press, but not by you. You call me clever, and I am. You and your mates haven't a clue that the photo in the paper gives me fits. And that bit about me killing myself, no chance. I got things to do. My purpose is to rid the streets of them sluts. My one regret is that young lassie McDonald. Did not know, because she changed her routine that night. Up to number 8 now. You say 7, but remember Preston in 75. You were right, I do travel a bit. You probably look for me in Sunderland, don't bother, I'm not daft. Just posting a letter there on one of my trips. Not a bad place compared with Chapel Town and Manningham and other places. Warn those horses to keep off the street because I feel it coming on again. Sorry about the young lassie. Yours respectfully, Jack the Ripper." It's an extraordinary letter. And Linda, I'm sure you agree, it feels more like fiction than fact. But there it is. It is the letter that they received. At first, the police were inclined to see it as a hoax, but then the mention of the Preston murder threw them, because the police didn't believe that information about the Preston murder was in the public domain. It was a murder which they had yet to attribute to Sutcliffe, and as it transpired, it wasn't committed by the Ripper at all. But its mention in the letter convinced them that perhaps it was a genuine letter after all. A year later, the Chief Constable received a second envelope. This one contained a cassette tape. The accent was crucial and completely threw the investigation off course, as they ignored the earlier witness evidence and pursued a man with a Wearside or Sunderland accent. Sutcliffe was questioned 4 times during this period and then released each time as its accent did not fit that on the tape. The police continued to look for a man with a Sunderland accent right up until the point that Sutcliffe was arrested, which, as is so often the case, was the result of extreme good fortune. He was arrested while picking up a prostitute, and he was found to have knives and a hammer on him. He confessed during questioning, and it was only then that Wearside Jack was confirmed as a hoax. After his arrest, Sutcliffe said of the hoax, "While ever that was going on, I felt safe. I'm not a Geordie. I was born in Shipley," which, as it happens, is just outside of Bradford. Wearside Jack's identity remained a mystery for 25 years until, in 2005, the case was reopened. A fragment from one of Humble's envelopes was traced to him through DNA, and he was questioned. It was during that period that examples of his handwriting were sent to London for analysis and examined by our guest today. document examination expert, Chris Davies. Well, let's pick up the story there. Chris, welcome. What do you remember about the case and when you first heard about it?
Well, the first involvement I had was actually early in 2005, when work was sent down from West Yorkshire. And in fact, it wasn't in relation to John Humble. The person who I was asked to look at was a chap called John Mather. I don't know how he became involved in the case. I was asked to look at handwriting and the letters and reported. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I can only assume that since it went no further, I must have said there was no evidence that he was the writer. It wasn't until early November that I finally got involved with actually looking at material from Humble. I remember being contacted to say that they had some writing from a suspect and would I be able to do a comparison. Now, even in those days, transmission of handwriting wasn't as easy as it is now, and they said they would fax the samples of handwriting down to London. That's not ideal because obviously you lose a lot of detail of the handwriting when it's faxed, because faxes are clearly not very high resolution. For some strange reason, we also had problems with the fax machine. It had about, I think it's about 30 pages to fax, and it kept on disconnecting after about five pages, and it took several attempts to get all the handwriting down. But we did eventually manage to get everything down. I remember keeping on walking the length of the lab to the fax, the liaison fax machine to pick up the next bit that had arrived. Very high-tech stuff. They were fairly insistent that it was done. It was quite late in the afternoon when it came down, but they said they needed to have a result reasonably quickly because they were running up against the custody time, as I remember, running up against the custody time limit. And they needed some evidence that would justify them going to the relevant authorities and asking for an extension. Now, as you say, there was DNA around time, but to get a DNA result then took longer than it does now. There's obviously no fast DNA. And so a DNA result would not be available within the time limit that they had. So they just needed something that would enable them to say, well, we've got a reasonable suspect. It took me 4 days before I finally gave them a result. So I gave them a verbal result. And if I remember right, it was pretty much along the lines of, you can't exclude this person. So it's not a clear no evidence. He's a possible writer, which, of course, would have been enough then to get the custody time limit extended, which, as I understood, is obviously what happened.
What were the documents that you received by fax, Chris?
I can't remember now. It was just about 30 pages of miscellaneous documents. It would have been course of business material. That's to say, as far as I can remember, it wasn't samples that had been taken at request. And obviously, with handwriting, you can have two sorts of known writing. You can have samples that the police have actually asked the suspect to write, which have some advantages in that you can absolutely be certain that the suspect wrote them. And you have course of business writings, which are writings that are done by the suspect in normal day-to-day business. They have the advantage of being obviously natural, which samples may not be. But on the other hand, you have the disadvantage that it may be more difficult to actually prove that the suspect wrote them. But where you've got things which are clearly very personal to the suspect, usually it's okay to treat them as the known writing of that individual. Although at the end of the day, you will have to prove it to court if it does go to court. And so I seem to remember it was course of business writings that I was being asked to compare, which obviously were in some ways the best material for that sort of comparison.
How fast did you, on comparison, you said it took 4 days, but how fast could you see that this was the culprit?
Well, I think the first stage, of course, was this thing of the custody time limits, which really was more about, was there evidence it wasn't him? Now, the thing that people think about handwriting is that when you're looking at handwriting, you're looking for similarities. And obviously, that is important. But one of the crucial things is looking for differences. if you've got two different writers, even if they've been taught the same writing, they will have lots of similarities, but they will have some differences. So for an initial examination, what you're probably, or what I would be doing, is going through and saying, can I find differences? If I can't find differences, then we're in a situation where we're saying, okay, there is now a possibility that this person is the writer. So that would be what I'd look for. And, you know, in some cases, I have gone through and said, well, there's three or four differences. It can't be the same writer.
So is it the common denominator, like an unusual ticking of a T, a looped L, and you matching them?
Well, that's one stage. So the first thing you'd be looking at is actually, which you cannot do from faxed writings, of course, looking at the general features of the writing. Is it the right style? Is it the right size? Does it have the same slope? Those sorts of features, which everybody can see in handwriting. You know, if they are the same, then you know, you're starting to get a situation where you're at least got a possibility it's the same writer. But clearly, there will be lots of people who have the same style and have the same slope. So what you're then looking at, yes, is the detail of the writing, is the way the actual letters are formed when a person writes. So as you say, it may be an unusual way of crossing a T. It may be the direction that someone does an O. Do they do it clockwise or do they do it anti-clockwise? So those are the sorts of detail you'll be looking at.
Yeah, I just wonder, Chris, if you knew, they obviously faxed everything down to you. I should say Chris is hiding his light under a bushel there. They probably sent it to him because he is one of the best at what he does, and that's well known in the forensic world. But I wonder if you know, did they submit it anywhere up at Weatherby or to you in the end for any on the pages or the envelope for any indented writing?
Well, because what you've got to remember is that the letters had already been fingerprinted.
So, yes.
And of course, one of the things that would have happened if they had been received in 2005 is they would have been examined for indented impressions using an electrostatic technique. The problem is that that technique is rendered unusable by fingerprint treatment. So it always has to be done before fingerprinting. And of course, the letters have been fingerprinted back in the 1970s when they were originally received. So that was a non-starter.
And what is an indented impression?
If you're writing on a sheet of paper that's resting on other sheets of paper, then the writing will create impressions on the underlying sheets. How many sheets it will create impressions on depends to a large extent on how much pressure you write with. With ball pens, you may get impressions down through several sheets. Now, on the first sheet down, you may actually be able to see them. You can shine a light at low angle across the document, you actually see indentations in the document. But if you're using an electrostatic technique, you can detect impressions on underlying sheets where you may not be able to see any physical indentation in the surface of the paper. I was reading about a case where they had a threatening letter and they had a suspect, and the handwriting was not the suspect's writing. But when they looked at the pad that the sheet had come from and did the indented impression, or did indent impressions on the document, there was a draft of the letter which was in the suspect's handwriting. And it appears he'd written out a draft and then given it to an accomplice so the accomplice could write it.
That is fantastic. And it occurs to me that indented impressions are a favourite of filmmakers. They're always showing someone using a pencil to shade in an indented impression with pencil. Does that actually work, Chris?
I have seen it done, and it's not a good idea because it does interfere with electrostatic detection later on.
Can I ask you, Chris, that now, because of the computer age, you know, they can run a fingerprint through the computer and within seconds they have a match. Is there that same kind of advance on handwriting? Is there now a computerized factor that can be used to identify handwriting?
There are automated handwriting systems available. There's one which was developed in Germany, in fact, back in, I think, the 1980s, called Fish, which does provide an automated system for searching handwriting, and it will provide you with a list of the closest matches, a bit like the automated fingerprint system does. Because the difficulty is that you have to build up the database.
Yeah.
Now, in Germany, providing handwriting samples was a requirement in the same way as providing fingerprints was a requirement. In the UK, it's not. You can always refuse to provide handwriting samples. And so no database like that's ever been built up of handwriting samples that can be searched. But yes, it's perfectly possible to do it. And there are systems around for doing it.
I suppose that begs the question of just how individual our handwriting really is. I mean, is it actually unique, Chris? And can it easily be copied or not?
Well, the general principle of handwriting is that if you have sufficient handwriting of an individual, it will be unique. And of course, the crucial word there is sufficient. Obviously, you know, people are taught how to write. And so if you get a class of children taught how to write, they're all going to be taught basically the same style. So what makes your handwriting unique is how it changes from the basic taught style over the years. Nowadays, people tend to change quite a lot because their styles aren't taught as rigorously as they used to be. If you go back to Victorian times when people were all taught copperplate, then you find that, you know, different people's writings are very similar. If you get into the 70s and 80s, handwriting was much less rigorously taught, and therefore, you know, people's writing does tend to be more variable. But each individual will have features in their writing somewhere that's the combination of which will make that writing unique. And that's the other thing. You're looking at a combination of features. It's not that one feature makes it unique. It's a particular combination of features that makes a person's writing unique. If you're trying to pretend you're someone else, is that not only do you have to get all those features right, but you also have to produce writing of the correct quality. And because writing is largely a subconscious act. When you write, you think about the content of what you're writing, not about the actual movement of the pen on the paper. When you're trying to reproduce someone else's writing, then you're thinking about the pen movement, and that makes the writing unnatural. It will make it slow. You may find that you have to stop and think about what you're doing next, and all these things, you know, mean that the fluency of the writing goes. So copied writing tends not to be very fluent.
Linda asked earlier about technology helping your investigations, Chris. But what about technology making it harder? Presumably the introduction of the first typewriter and then the computer has made it much more difficult for you to compare and identify. Though, having said that, I seem to remember that typewriters have unique characteristics as well. Is that right?
Yes. Typewriters, well, you had two issues. Obviously, you had the issue of damage to the characters, which were one thing which might make a typewriter unique. But certainly with old-fashioned typewriters, with type bars, the actual construction of them meant that even ones, as they came off the production line, consecutive ones, could be distinguished because the type bars would have a bit of flexibility. So you would get precision of position was not the same. So with sufficient analysis, you could actually say the alignment of the letters is slightly different on consecutively produced typewriters. So typewriters were unique. When you got onto electric machines, particularly ones that have their own single element machines like golf balls and print wheel typewriters, that became a bit more difficult because, of course, you could take the print wheel out and put it into a different machine. And of course, as they got damaged, they could be replaced, although that in itself created opportunities because sometimes you could actually date documents by looking at the damage on a print wheel and showing that as the damage built up, you could say what the order of documents were in terms of their production. And I've certainly done cases where I was able to say from damage that this document must have been produced within a limited period of time because it fitted that pattern of print wheel damage.
Can I ask you, Chris, in my research looking at all the documentaries about the Hope's letter, the two men that were asked to check the letters from the hoaxer were adamant at one point, saying they did not believe that the writer of these letters was a murderer. I mean, I don't know how they got to that point, but they also discovered that there were sections of his hoax letters to the police that he'd copied out of old newspaper articles on the original Ripper's letters. But they were very, very adamant that they could tell from that handwritten note that he was not a murderer. Is there something to say this person could have actually psychopathic tendencies? Are you able to detect that?
I think the issue there is that there are two ways of doing handwriting analysis. There's the forensic document examiner, which I am. We are concerned with comparisons and the identity of authors.
Mm-hmm.
There is a field called graphology, which is looking at personality. Now, there's a lot of dispute amongst forensic document examiners and among some psychologists to how accurate graphology is. But that is a separate field, and it's a field that I've never been involved in. And so all I would say is that from my readings, I have some questions about it, but it's not a field that I'm an expert in. So it's quite interesting that information was provided in the early part of the inquiry, because I'd be interested to know where they actually sent the letters to get that. Because at the time, in terms of the forensic side of it, I'd have expected the letters to have gone to the Birmingham laboratory of the Home Office Forensic Science Service, as it then was. And I wouldn't have thought that they would have said something like that.
Very diplomatically put, Chris. Yeah, that's an interesting point, though, isn't it? Because, you know, I think the police just got it into their heads that these were real and ignored all the warnings to the contrary. I think I'm right in saying that even the FBI got in touch to say that they thought they were fake, but the police just kept on going.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be fair to them, I suppose, the mention of the Preston murder really had thrown them off. And then I think there was an additional piece of evidence, Kaz, wasn't there, where they had the saliva on the letter matched a piece of evidence that they'd found at the Preston murder, which was a type of saliva which was only 8% of the population had. And so, again, it narrowed it down. It convinced them, because they were already convinced, it sort of confirmed their conviction that these letters were from the real Ripper. So perhaps they had good cause for following up. But Kaz, it does seem to me that they're a little too eager to put all their eggs in one basket. Is that fair?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think part of the... In those days, when you had chief superintendents that running murders, they were the gods. And they would decide which way to go. And even if there were others who said, well, I'm not too sure, some would be frightened to say something because you'd get shot down. Other people would, and it would be ignored. And I mean, I think the Ripper case is actually a prime example, because there was a detective, or a couple of detectives in that, who said about his car being stopped, being seen in the area. One officer went to visit him, and he said about, you know, he was a lorry driver and everything, and kept saying, I think this guy could be the man. But it was ignored, and everything went down that track. But the problem is that once a detective sometimes gets something in their mind, if somebody, you know, he did it, I know he did it, I'm going to find everything to prove he did it. So everything goes down that line. Whereas if detectives investigating offences are sort of based, used a forensic science base of like a likelihood, you know, this is what I know, how likely is it that this person has done that or whatever, it keeps you balanced. You don't become subjective, you're more objective. You look at all the different things that tell you, well, yeah, that tells me I might be right, but then that tells me I could be wrong. But it's about challenging yourself and considering everything, all the evidence you've got, and as new evidence comes in, go over your old stuff again to compare it and make to see if your theory that you think is still fitting the scenario. And they kind of like did put their eggs all in one basket, and this was a hoax. But at the end of the day, if you turn it the other way, and let's say that hoax, what was believed to be a hoax, actually turned out to be the killer, and you had said, now we think they're hoaxes, you know, it could have been the other way. Whereas the thing is to say, well, it could be a hoax, but we're treating as it's possibly the genuine. Whatever happens, we are investigating this case to find who the killer was. And at the end of the day, that will resolve the issue over the letter and the recordings. So you're actually, you know, so you're not saying, you know, we see this as gospel, because whatever happens, you've still got to, they had to fully investigate those letters, but they shouldn't have let them lead the inquiry that much. They should have been a bit more open-minded.
Yes, I just, obviously, we're talking about the Yorkshire Ripper and the hoax letter, but I know that in most of the most infamous serial killers, Ted Bundy, the Zodiac serial killer, the Boston Strangler, they received hundreds of letters claiming that they were the perpetrator. And I just wondered if, Chris, have you had to deal with other letters similar in content to a claimant saying, I am the killer?
No, I can't recall any other case of that sort which I've been involved in. I mean, obviously, you know, as you say, in these cases, a lot of the letters, well, most of the letters are going to be hoax letters. And the involvement, as I said earlier on, if you don't have a suspect, really the only thing that the document examiner can do is to look at them and say, is there evidence they are the same person? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we've certainly had malicious communications where you've had multiple letters received, and the evidence, all that the document examiner could do if there were no impressions, was to say, well, you are looking at a series, that this is the same writer. And indeed, we had one instance where we'd been reporting a series of malicious communications as being the same writer for 2 or 3 years, and then they got some DNA linkage, and everybody was going on, have we got a link in? Yeah, we've got a link, a series of malicious communications. And we just said to the police, we've been reporting this as a series for the last 3 years. Any attention until you got the DNA result?
Yeah, I think following in from what you just said there, one of the interesting byproducts of the case was that there was a report into the police investigations and the failings of the police investigation. And it concluded that following their call for public help, they used the handwriting, if I remember, from the letter and asked people if they recognised it.
Yeah.
And they were so overwhelmed with leads that it led to an enormous amount of paperwork, and they had to reinforce the floor of the investigation room, I seem to remember, because they couldn't take the weight of it, and they had such, and they simply didn't have the manpower to go through it. And it led to the adoption of computers in police investigations after that, just to deal with large amounts of data. Is that right? Do you remember that?
Well, just to store, really, because anything is only as good as the data you're putting in. And if you're putting in the correct data, then that's going to be helpful. Really, it was storing it would allow you to, and computers would allow you to retrieve. So if, for example, you had somebody in a red scarf came up a few times, or this red scarf, for example, you can then put into the homes, run red scarf, and you'll get every detail of whoever said red scarf, whoever saw red scarf, et cetera, et cetera. So it was helpful in that way sort of looking at other, for similarities, but it's also helpful, you know, for putting all the case files in, and it allows you to compare against other cases and everything. So in that respect, I think, yeah, but the problem they had was, I mean, when I first joined the police as well, I mean, we had investigating a murder, there was a big carousel in the middle of the table, and the indexers would just fill out cards, and the cards would go on there. And the longer an inquiry went on, there was more and more cards. Then it would be two great big rotating with more cards. Then it would become filing cabinets, and then another filing cabinet, and as information went in. But now, every statement, everything is typed in and put into the computer. So it allows you easy access to look back to see what you've done, where you've been, sort of thing. And But I still think some of the best information is detectives and scientists sitting together in a room discussing their case, and the civilian indexes, which when I was always used to happen. Now they've just put them all in an office, and they're all working on different cases. And it'd be quite often, because a civilian had typed up a load of statements or read through statements, somebody would say something in a meeting, and one of them was, hang on a minute, so-and-so who made a statement, that doesn't connect with that's not right. So that feeding of information between each other was there. And, you know, if they hadn't said it, nobody may go back and check, even on a computer. If it's on a computer, you might not think to go back and check it. So it's, you know, working together is always it gets you the best results.
So having examined these documents sent by fax, Chris, you said that they shouldn't discount this person. What would you have needed to be more conclusive?
Well, ideally, I'd have wanted to get the actual original writing from the handwriting samples, or the known handwriting, because obviously you can see a lot more detail in that. As I mentioned earlier, what you're going to be looking at are things like the direction that the pen's moving when forming letters. Pressure can be an issue, and that all gets lost in faxes. You're really looking at fairly low level detail in a fax. You might be able to determine a direction. You can certainly determine things like proportions of letters, but if you're looking at a fax, it's very unlikely you're going to be able to see the detail that tells you whether a cross stroke is done from left to right or right to left, whether an O is clockwise or anti-clockwise. You might get an indication, but you're not likely to be sure of it. And so you're going to be limited in what you can actually conclude at the end of the day. But obviously the crucial evidence was when the DNA came in, because of course that was going to be much stronger evidence. A qualified handwriting conclusion is useful corroboration, but clearly on its own, it's not enough to ensure a conviction in a criminal case. It may be enough for a verdict in a civil case, but certainly not in a criminal case.
Chris, I just wanted, you mentioned earlier, Linda asked about, the psychology of what people write. I just kind of wondered with, like spelling and things like that. But of course, somebody could fake that to make it look like they're not very intelligent. But I wondered if you've ever had any cases where, like a particular word, for example, it was a fraud case involving the old GLC applications for student grants. But on all the applications, they put down mathematics, but it was spelt mathematics. So we had that recurring. I wonder if you have anything like that, that gives you a link to say, well, this every time this word is spelt wrong.
I mean, certainly, if you've got consistent misspellings, it's something you would consider. But you've got to be cautious about what the misspelling is, because some words are commonly misspelt by a large number of people. And so you may find that, two different people just happen to misspell word in the same way. But when you're reaching a conclusion, you're going to look at, as you should do in anything, you're going to look at all the evidence that's available to you. Now, if you've got similar misspellings, yes, it's something that you will think about, but I wouldn't put a huge weight on it. Similarly, if you've got similar phraseology continually but recurring again, you'd note it, and you might think, well, it fits in with the rest of the handwriting, but it wouldn't be something that you would latch on to and say, just because of that, I'm going to say that it's the same writer.
Chris, can I ask you how much the gathering of evidence in a situation like this has changed since the Yorkshire Ripper case?
Well, really, I can only go back to when I started work, which is sort of in the early 1980s. I started as a document examiner in 1981. And the gathering of certainly handwriting evidence has always been pretty much the same, that you need to get one of two types of writing. You need to get samples, which are done at request. The issue there is that there's no compulsion, or generally no compulsion, available to persuade a person to write. And they do have a disadvantage that, of course, they are written in a situation where the writer is under some sort of stress. Even if they're completely innocent, they're still under stress because they're in a police interview. So that can affect the samples. The course of business writings, again, that's down to the police being able to go out and find writings that they can confidently assign to the suspect. The sorts of things they used to get were, quite often they get things like personal diaries and sort of address books. And we always used to say they aren't actually ideal, because they're particularly the address books, because they're the sorts of things people hand over to others and say, can you write your address in there for me, please? And so you often find that there's more than one writer in something like an address book. A desk diary would be another one where perhaps a secretary might be, if it was a business one, secretary's writing in it as well as the person concerned. So what you're really looking for are personal things, so personal letters. Classic one would be perhaps letters written to a member of the family or a girlfriend or something like that, which you could reasonably confidently say was the was that individual. I did have one case where I had six letters from a person in prison, and five of them I said to the officer were the writing of, I was happy to take as known writing, and I said I wasn't going to take the sixth because in my view it wasn't his writing. And they said, well, we know it's his writing because he's a prisoner and he's written these letters from prison. And I said, well, I don't care, this one isn't, I don't think it's his writing, I'm not using it. About a week or so later, they come back and say, you were right, we discovered that he was attacked in prison and the attacker broke his right arm, so he couldn't write. So one of his fellow inmates wrote this letter for him. But, of course, the other issue that you have is obviously is protecting the material and ensuring the continuity of it. There are a number of ways that you can do that. The classic one, obviously, is to use a police evidence bag. Some of them have a disadvantage because the continuity panel's in the middle of the bag. And if you write on that and write the continuity, you create indented impressions all over the documents that are inside it. But that's the sort of thing that, you know, officers have to be aware of, is that, you know, they need to be careful about how they record the continuity of the exhibits, which obviously is crucial, but can also be damaging to the exhibits themselves.
I'm very interested in the kind of future of handwriting. I mean, my son, for example, a teenager, sometimes when I see his handwriting, it's like an immature 11-year-old. But as soon as he picks up a mobile phone or on a computer, his hands fly over the keys. He's 20 times faster than me. So I wonder if the actual process of physical handwriting is going to be almost obsolete in the future.
Well, obviously, you know, handwritten documents are less common than they were, you know, 40, 50 years ago. But the handwriting hasn't ceased to be relevant. You've still got, for example, signatures are still required in many cases to authenticate transactions. Some people will still find that it's easier to make a note on a notepad and hand it to someone rather than try to send a text with their phone, particularly if you're out of mobile contact or haven't got a good mobile signal. People are still writing. There are areas where writing is less common. When I started work, checks were a big thing, and clearly they've largely disappeared. But you still find people being involved in check cases. The type of case has changed, but people still do write checks, and there are still check frauds going on. In, you know, commercial fraud cases, you'll still sometimes find that there are a lot of documents involved. And in fact, one thing that where documents have sort of come back almost is that in sometimes organised crime and terrorist groups will actually use documents and transport documents around, because if you move something as a piece of paper, say on a flight, and hand it to someone, there's no electronic trail for the law enforcement agencies to pick up. So in fact, you know, electronic communications are, even encrypted ones, are less, can be less secure than actually using documents.
Well, that's all we've got time for. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Linda, Kaz, Chris. It's been another eye-opening episode looking at a case that continues to intrigue true crime fans everywhere. We'll be back next week for episode 4 on DNA and the case of Colin Pitchfork and the murder of Colette Aram. Make sure to subscribe to the series wherever you're listening now so you don't miss an episode. And if you're really enjoying the podcast, please leave a nice rating too. And if you want to know more about the podcast and Linda's books, check out her website at lindalaplante.com. Her new novel, Vanished, is out on the 31st of March in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. Until next week, thanks for listening.